Leah Brown, interviewing Dr. Bill Mizey for the Slippery Rock University Oral History Program. This is 17 September 1991. And we're going to begin with the beginning, freshman year at Slippery Rock.
Yes, it was my early fond memories of Slippery Rock dates back to the fall of 1940, when fresh out of high school I had the opportunity to look forward to being a student at Slippery Rock. Those days in my undergraduate program extended from 1940, 41, 42, and during that time I remember the closeness of the campus. We had approximately 400 students, 350 women, about 150 men. We lived in the old South Hall, which has been demolished for some time now. We had a dean of men that lived on the first floor, and venture to say lots happened between the students and the dean of men over the course of an academic year. There could be a lot of dormitory stories. I would just narrate one. The dean used to like to keep order and would patrol the halls, and on this one occasion, this one group was sort of rowdy, and so he knocked on the dean knocked on the exterior of the door and demanded to know what was going on in there. And one of the boys, not knowing who it was, said, "Well, throw a lot of water under the door and swim through." And so this was the type of life that the dean lived in those days. The women had a similar situation, having a women's dean who they called Gummy, because she was deft of foot and very quiet in her movements around the halls, which of course caught some of the women in embarrassing situations. Our hours were rather rigid. Through the week we had to be in the dorms. Well, the women had to be in her dorms 7:45, and so the men might as well go study. And so that was the predication of the hours. On Saturday night, the women usually had 12 o'clocks, and so consequently that was social night. Friday night, maybe 10 o'clocks, and the rest of the time it was early socializing or none at all. The high part of the day, as I recall, in those undergraduate years was right after dinner, when in the hut there was always records played, and we could go up there and dance from the end of dinner until 7:45, at which time the women had to be tucked away in North Hall. There were other stories that could be related. Since the security was rather tight in the girls' dormitory, occasionally the men would tie bed sheets together and try to gain entrance through windows, second, first, and second story windows, and sometimes would be successful and sometimes would be caught in the process. I would imagine that most colleges across the country were having things of that nature take place during that time. As I look back on it, the institution was strictly a teacher preparation, elementary, secondary, and health and physical education. That was it. The program was rigid. Everyone took the same thing in the same major. So if I were to enroll at that time, I knew that the second semester I was going to have chemistry as a health and physical education major. As a sophomore, I knew I was going to have anatomy, and so on. There was no choice for electives. And of course, that way, they were assured that you were well prepared and could meet all the emergencies of teaching, which we were to experience later on. The sports program was fairly extensive, and back in those days, we dominated because, of course, we were the big health and physical education school, and we had probably more athletes than some of the other state colleges or state teachers' colleges, as they called them. I remember our going down and playing down in California one year. They had a lot of their big school major was industrial arts. And of course, they had a lot of good industrial arts potential, but many of them didn't have too much football potential. And so if they did get their helmets on correctly, why, we tended to spin them around, and usually the games were fairly one-sided. And of course, as part of this, Coach N. Kurt Thompson is a legend in his own right. Over the years, of course, I was fortunate enough to play for Coach in his last two or three seasons before World War II, and of course, stories abound for years prior to that, since he was a longtime mentor of both the football and basketball programs and baseball programs here at Slippery Rock. We had a great time. There were no cars. Well, there was one car on campus, and it didn't run. It sat out on the Morrow Circle, and it was mainly for the kids would crawl in there on cold nights, or it was there mainly as a show place. If the students went home, they maybe were picked up by their parents, or they hitchhiked, or they rode into Pittsburgh with the milk truck driver, or they sought out some type of transportation of that nature. So consequently, most of the student body went home at Thanksgiving, at Christmas, maybe in the spring toward Easter, and that was it. The rest of the time they were here. The academic and week extended basically beginning Monday morning, running through Saturday at noon. We had heavy classes. The classes were scheduled Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, regularly. And of course, they took a dim view of anyone missing classes, period, and on Saturday they were particularly suspicious, so that's about the way it was. So we had short weekends. The I would say the mores of the time, there were five or seven little older students, and some of them all smoked a pipe on occasion, or maybe smoked cigarettes on occasion, but that was about it. If a woman smoked, she was suspect as far as the teaching profession was concerned. All our meals were quite formal. The white tablecloths served. We had hosts and hostesses who were rotated. Everyone got to eat with everyone else before the year was out. Manners and proper cultural eating experience was emphasized as part of the educational process. After my freshman year, I was fortunate enough to get a waiter's job, and you say fortunate, well, we were paid 20 cents a meal, which was great, helped with our college expenses also. But the biggest fringe was we didn't have to dress as formally as the rest of the students. We had our white waiter's coats and that over our regular classroom garb. Everyone else had to dress for dinner. Women had to wear hose and suits or dresses. Men had to have ties and coats on. So it was a preparation time to, as a result, some few students used to miss meals on occasion because of the dress code. However, most everyone attended. During meals, sometimes there'd be a pause in the between courses, and there would be pep songs, and before a game there'd be pep songs and rallies and that sort of thing, and announcements. Sometimes some of the groups, academic groups, would make their announcements, meeting tonight, and so on. So it was a time of communication and fellowship. Then right after dinner, of course, everyone would flock to the hut, which is now called the one of the art buildings, I think. The hut, which had a very nice floor and was originally constructed by the YMCA and was put there for cultural, semi-religious experiences. We had the chapel, which you can hear many of experienced Slippery Rock people talk about. It's a beautiful gray-stoned twin-towered building at the top of the circle there at Morrow Drive. And in the chapel, architecturally it was quite distinctive, but in the chapel, weekly there was held, and Sunday night, every Sunday night was held chapel meetings. It was interdenominational, but everyone was to attend. And during the year 40 to 43, everyone had an assigned seat, and they sort of took roles, and if your seat was empty too often, the dean or someone, the dean of men, or social deans would bring that to your attention. Now, if you were home for the weekend, you were expected to get back in time for chapel. And it was usually a interdenominational sort of church service. I could hardly see it functioning today in our climate. But in those days, it sort of met its needs. And then through the week, they would have sometimes special speakers and maybe special musical groups during what would be an assembly period, which everyone, they would dispense classes at that time. And that would be part of it. Looking back on the whole procedure, I mean, it was a great opportunity for interpersonal dynamics. I mean, your roommate and what he did and people across the hall was a great part of the educational process. And the faculty members were, they lived there, they ate there. It was an in-house type thing. The faculty members were also about as cloistered as the students. I mean, they lived in the dormitories or lived very close to the campus, and they took their meals right there with the students. And if you wanted to engage over dinner or conversation about a particular subject, perhaps you were sitting with a subject teacher, and they did assign the teachers throughout the dining hall, maybe one at each table. If you happen to have the chemistry teacher for 2 weeks, you could talk chemistry with him if you cared to, you know. Or with the English professor, you could talk novels or whatever you cared to get, glean a little extra if you cared to. And some of that took place. I would suspect that by the end of the day, the faculty members were happy to just have dinner and talk about something else. So it was an interesting time. It was a happy time. Students were all, I would say, that were there. They were there by choice, and they were going to be teachers, and it was a happy time. The then, of course, things rapidly changed. We war became activated. Most of us were reservists of one kind. We were called up, most of us, and the campus changed drastically. It got down to the place where only a few men left who had physical problems, and maybe 200, 250 women. And it was shortly after that why the Air Corps got into arrangements. It so happened that we had Army unit stationed here. I think they brought in 400 or 500 or 800 Army units, and it became a military camp with these 250 women and 3 or 4 civilian men still pursuing their studies. And so I don't know too much about that myself, because I was gone for 3 years and came back in 46 and finished my senior year. I was taken out after my junior year and went to military, went to OCS and became a officer in the Navy, so came back in 46, and there were some changes. There were, I think there was a few more electives in the curriculum. The enrollment was up slightly, maybe 500, 600, and I went on and took a semester of classes, which I enjoyed because I had a little different insight after those 3 years in the Pacific, and I had a little better understanding of what I was really there for. And so I gained probably more from my studies. Then went into, at that time, you had to have student teaching and pre-professional activities, which I enjoyed, and I ended up, teachers were very in short supply at the time. So up there in Cottesport, North Tier, Central Pennsylvania, the coach and physical education teacher came down with indolent fever from consuming unpasteurized milk. This was in the middle of the school year. So they had sort of an emergency. They called down at the time to the laboratory school where I was doing my student teaching, wanting to know if anyone was available, that the deal would be that they could go up there, finish their student teaching, they would supervise them up there, and also pay them substitutes' wages. And so they had the student, I was halfway through my student teaching experience here at the lab school, and Dr. Wagenhurst, the director at the time, came in my class this one day where I was teaching, and right after class he observed, and after class he said, "Bill, how would you like to go up to Cottesport? They have an emergency up there." And so he told me the deal. I said, well, I had a car at the time and I was on GI Bill, so it sounded like a good deal, good experience. So jumped in the car and went up there, was ready for the next Monday's opening of classes, and took over their basketball team and had a good time up there in the North Woods. It was cold, but it was a good professional experience. So then I was fortunate to reflect back some of the classwork they sent Yes, we had one class that we had to take in conjunction with our student teaching, and I met with the superintendent up there once a week, and he had a written exam for me over the content of this course. And I remember I had to study the text at the time, take this test every week, and then he would send it back here. And at the end of the year, the semester, why they graduated me and gave me credit for everything, and worked out pretty well. And I had good recommendations up there, so worked out pretty well. Then I went off and worked in the public schools for 7 years, which was great, and had the opportunity to come back to Slippery Rock here in 1953 as a faculty member, junior faculty member, connected with the laboratory school, which I accepted, came in here in October of 1953, and set about settling in to the niche of a laboratory school teacher. Now, back in those days, the laboratory school was supposed to be a laboratory school. I mean, out on the cutting edge of new educational methods, with lots of glass enclosed anti-rooms in the back of the class for observations and that sort of thing. I also had student teachers from the college, roughly about 37 a semester. So I'd have two or three student teachers with each class, public school class. These were really public school youngsters in the laboratory school. And that was, I enjoyed that because it gave me an opportunity to explore with the college students what was happening in the field, and kept us all up to date. And that worked out very nicely. After about 3 years, due to financial problems, all laboratory schools were dispensed with, pretty much, starting here, and it pretty much happened across the state. And so now what used to be a combined educational effort, including college and local community, was distinctly separate. And in fact, it almost went so far that never the twain would meet. And unfortunately, that carried over for quite a number of years. Then, as I recalled later, as I got into deaning and other academic activity, we strove to increase the number of laboratory activities that we could get together. And so it just sort of ran full cycle. We almost had a complete separation, which then over a number of years we were able to get our students back into some classes in the Slippery Rock School District and gain some valuable benefits from that. Of course, in 1953 the enrollment was around 700. As a junior faculty member, the typical load, teaching load, was 18 to 22 hours. If things were tough, I had a lot of students in a particular area, where the chairman would usually approach and say, "Well, gee whiz, we've got all these students, you can handle another class or another 5 or 10, can't you?" You didn't have too much choice but to shake your head and go from there. Here again, the school week was Monday through noon on Saturday. Those of us in health and physical education coached 3 sports, plus usually carried these 18 to 22 hours. So we were busy. Either we're teaching, you're either coaching, or you were preparing for one of the two. I mean, there was very little coffee time or slack time. You had to love to teach, you had to love to work. And so consequently, there was a turnover for, I'd say, the first 10 years I was here. A number of faculty members came, maybe lasted 2 or 3 years, and then would take off for other pastures. I found the whole teaching experience sort of stimulating. You had lots to master. We also had a philosophy in the health and physical education teacher that department that if you really wanted to be a well-rounded teacher, you should teach it all. So consequently, if you had anatomy, kinesiology, and a couple of activities 1 year, well then next year we'd give you a couple other classes and some different activities. So you would learn to teach them all, you see. And that's what really happened in the course of, I'd say the first 5 years, I had taught about every class offered in the health and physical education area. And I had files on all of them. I was smart enough that as I taught each class, I developed a file and resource material. So I had these reams of filing cabinets full of all this stuff, which then, depending on what schedule I received, I'd pull out and I'd review them and, here we go, this is what we do in anatomy. And so would refresh ourselves and get started. But you had to also study along with the kids, so to speak, to keep up with things. So research opportunities were minimal. I mean, you just didn't have time or energy for it. Unless you got into graduate work, which, I had my master's degree before I came up, but I started after my coaching experience, which I enjoyed very much, which included in the first 5 years I was here, 6 years, 4 years head football, 4 years assistant basketball, 4 years track and field. So that was 12 years of coaching there in 4 years. So I thought, physically, this was going to be tough to sustain, particularly later in life. I thought, and I was interested in some of the other aspects, so we got into graduate study and went on, took doctoral work out in Colorado. I enjoyed it very much. I'm never sorry. But during those days, we had a great camaraderie among the faculty. John Eiler was very helpful. When we had to change assignments, we would help each other. I remember John Eiler, there was a woman on the staff, and myself had to go to swimming, had to teach swimming the following semester, which was very important because it was certified by Red Cross, and it was well-being at stake and safety and that sort of thing. So it was very, and John Eiler did a crackerjack job of teaching the swimming. But when we had to change teaching assignments, then we got together, the three of us, and he sort of laid out the program and the way to go about it. And how do you handle this swimming? I mean, we could all swim, we're all certified, and we were young people, but there's more to it than that, the techniques of it and the breaking it down and the hand and arm movements, and you had to be very precise on this, which John Eiler took the time to go over with us in detail, and we met almost weekly on it. That's just one example of what happened. And similar things happened when teaching assignments changed. So the faculty members really had to have a good camaraderie, had a lot of support for each other. Otherwise, I mean, it was survive together or, you know, sink alone type of thing. So, but the faculty members were of the highest caliber, I would say. Not necessarily, that's in health and physical education. This is the area that I'm familiar with. Not too many of the health and physical education faculty had advanced degrees. In fact, maybe one or two at the most. Now, advanced degrees were more common in the other areas. But then as time went on, the health and physical education faculty also got into the higher education swim, and so now I think today probably hold the same number of degrees as you'd find in any academic area. We, Ford Hess was another fond memory. He was track and cross-country coach and was very dedicated to it. Unfortunately, after about 10 years left and went out to California to teach in one of the California state colleges, we had teacher. And we had, I remember as a student and junior faculty member, I mean on May Day, we still had the Maypole dances and the May Day activities. So we'd dance and frolic out on the lawn supervised usually organized by the dance teacher and the gymnastic teacher. And everyone spent the day, the afternoon anyway, out on the front lawn in the May Day activities. Gymnastics was revered as a representation of the health and physical education program. I remember the gymnastic teams, men and women at the time, were not competitive teams. They were exhibition teams. And so they would do all their stuff, back and front somersault and horizontal bar and parallel bar and all that as an exhibition, and they would take this big trips to Newcastle, down through the city of Pittsburgh. City schools would love to have them for assembly programs and so on, and around the various public schools, along with some dancing. Usually they had a little, maybe half dozen, 12 dancers that was part of the program, and it was a set program, and this was an exhibition, and then afterward, there'd be a little explanation of how we have this program at Slippery Rock, and we would hope that you would all want to get involved in it, and so on. It was a sort of recruiting public relations thing, and the students all went out and put these on. So they would go around to the various schools and maybe put on 12 to 15 of these during the course of a winter, and that was really the purpose of it. Then as time went on, Wally Rose, who was a great colleague, came from Springfield, and he got sort of into competitive gymnastics, and after a fairly short time, the men and the women's gymnastic programs were divided and were strictly competitive teams. Now they've go down there and go through the intercollegiate events, the NCAA prescribed events where they were in competition with Pitt, West Virginia, whoever had a gymnastic team that wanted to schedule us, just like any of the other athletic teams. So it went completely full cycle from an exhibition to a competitive, fairly highly competitive, till today, where I think both programs have been disbanded. So there's an example, I mean, to follow the history of gymnastics, we would have seen quite a difference there. It would be interesting to take every sport and maybe every activity through the music, drama, publications, library, whatever of the current university, and trace it and see the ebbs and flows and how it's changed, and to make it what it is today. Of course, in the case of gymnastics, it's non-existent, but and probably in some other activities, the same would hold true. We had, just not digressing too much, getting back to the early days as a junior faculty member then, I taught all the courses, found it a very broadening experience, got into research in my doctoral program where I had the opportunity to use freshman classes here, for which I was thankful, and did my doctoral research and dissertation and thought it was great. Finished that up, and now am, rather than a junior faculty member, am more of a senior faculty member. And having been here and having seniority and having known every president since President Miller, gave me insight as to understand what happens in these state teachers' colleges, state college, university setting. And thinking back over it, I mean, I had, as a student, President Miller was here for the first year, and then Dr. Entz, and I think it's on record as a succession of presidents. But they all had their strengths and weaknesses, and they all had their trials and tribulations. And was interesting to know them all and see the impact that took place. History sort of indicates that 10 years is about the max amount of time that a president can be real functional, however I'm sure that can be disproven. I remember, actually I looked on Dr. Entz as a personal friend. I worked for him as part of my student employee and used to drive for him, and so I got to be very fond of him. And when we all went off to service, he bade us goodbye, and when we came back, I think he had retired. And, but it's the nature of the beast. You have a dynamic interaction taking place. There's a lot of influences exerting pressures, and I'm sure in today's situation the same holds true. An interesting study, I think, would be the budget fluctuations that has occurred over the years. I was through during my active years, I guess about maybe a half dozen budget emergencies, crunches, and they all pretty much ran about the same course. As a junior faculty member, I remember there were 700 students and buildings and facilities at the time, and in 3 years we over doubled the enrollment to where there was about 1,500, 1,600, and we didn't add a faculty member or in a new building or a thing. Didn't add a thing. And I remember saying to my colleagues, well, gee whiz, we must be pretty good. If either that or we were understaffed before, that we could double this operation and still not add anything. Well, that was the first budget crunch. Well, then things went along and loosened up a little, and our budgets improved a little, and people could see that roofs had to be repaired and that improvements had to be made, and we had to have more facilities. Well, then we got the field house off the ground, and when we moved from the east-west gym complex down to the new field house, I think it was around 60, 62, we filled it. I mean, there were no empty places in the new field house. We had accumulated enough students and equipment and everything up in the little east-west gym complex in that little facility that we could just move it all down and into the field house, and I mean, we just filled it nicely, and now we had some breathing room, but not much. Then, of course, since that time, 60, the field house has been filling. Same thing is taking place. Now I would suspect, I understand the students have added paddleball and handball courts and some other facilities, but I would suspect that they're pretty full to the brim now again. And how soon the new facility, which was talked about years ago, will come into being is anybody's guess. Here again, the ebb and flow of the budget. Right now we're in another budget crunch. These budget crunches usually come down from Harrisburg, usually involved in the statewide budget, usually resulting in severe cuts, and non-payment and so on is not new with the recent one. It occurred a number of times previously. I remember our faculty paychecks were not forthcoming for a month or so there on occasion. Back in the 70s, we had a budget crunch. So that was something you sort of got used to and you rolled with the punches. An exciting and interesting time to me was during our time of rapid expansion, and after the early 60s, and through the 60s, we were expanding, we had the budget, we were hiring, we were booming. And this was a lot different than I had experienced previously. I remember being charged with, and not just myself, but a number of the faculty members, being charged with the responsibility of, in our travels, also recruiting. And we were after faculty members in any discipline with advanced degrees who could really upgrade and contribute to the academic program. So if on occasions I had become department chairman of health and physical education, went to a number of national meetings and so on, but in the process of going to these meetings, I was always asked to go to from the University of Illinois, to the placement office, and they had the applicants lined up. And we went there, and as well as going to the meeting, which was close by, I think in St. Louis, we went to the University of Illinois and was there for a week or 10 days just interviewing applicants from any discipline, might be English, math, physics, any area. So, and our main objective then was to interest them in Slippery Rock, tell them about how nice it was and so on, and then get them to forward their credentials and apply to, if it was a physics teacher, to the chairman of physics or their committee, or if it was communication, speech, into that area. Of course, in health and physical education, where we could deal directly with them. And so that's what we did. We had, I'd say, 4 or 5 interviews every day at the center they had set up, and you could meet with these faculty members. And we have faculty members on the campus today that got here from that process. But we were out nationally trying to recruit the best we could, best young people. They were mainly people coming right out of doctoral programs, out of graduate programs, who were willing to locate or were seeking positions. Yes, I'm sure that we have some on campus today that came out of those programs. So, but that was quite exciting. We had to increase our faculty. We were looking for maybe 40, 50, 60, 80 faculty members with advanced degrees at one time. And because we were going to lose some, we knew there was a certain amount of attrition. And we were expanding new programs, new courses, new opportunities. And as we expanded to gain faculty, now back on campus here, we were going through the rigors of expanding programs, which programs were going to expand, which ones are going to contract. But mainly we were expanding. We weren't contracting many. And so we're expanding everything and anything that we thought there was a need for. And at the time in health and physical education, I remember, by that time it was a school, and I was serving as the dean, rather than one program, we expanded to separate programs in recreation and resources management into pre-physical therapy, into nursing, into health science as a separate program, as in health and physical education, both teaching and non-teaching. So and that was typical of every program on campus. So this was a period of rapid, exciting expansion, which I think would be noticeable in any historic study. Continuing with that, now we have approved programs in physical therapy and nursing and accounting and business and those areas which 20 years ago would have been overlooked by most. So it's amazing how we've grown, expanded, and developed as an institution. Always strong and peppy as a social entity, I guess, as still reflected on by some of the activities in the fraternities and down at the College Garden Apartments, but we won't talk about that to any great extent. Always in athletics and activities, although today we don't excel in certain athletic areas quite as much because parity has been reached and other institutions are also strong in that area. And you're into recruiting and scholarships back in the beginning days, the only scholarship anyone had was maybe what their family could provide for them or what they could work through the summer to attain. That was the only scholarship available to you. Of course, now the costs are quite a bit greater. As an undergraduate, we paid $400 a year, $200 a semester, and that included room and board and laundry. They had laundry on campus, and so each week you had your soiled laundry in a laundry bag there, and they picked it up and did it and returned it back to your room most of the time. Some of the students lost items, so they were a little gun-shy of the laundry. But so you see, they tell me before my time, they grew everything that pretty much that was consumed in the dining hall, they grew on campus. And so their meat, one of the local cooks was also raised cattle and stuff, and that's where they got their meat. They had gardens and they grew a lot of stuff that they ate, and so it's pretty much a self-contained pastoral type setting. Oh, I remember the first 10-15 years there were a big herd of sheep right south of the campus that roamed freely there, and it was not until fairly recent times that those sheep were, that property was sold to the state and those sheep were eliminated. So we had a very pastoral setting in the early days, and which led up to our current sort of quasi-cosmopolitan status. Here we're setting out in the country and can commute to the city, and the students do commute there. So it's sort of a different situation. The the trustees back in the earlier days, I think trustees were all appointed. Trustees usually changed with each administration, and trustees were, I would say, more political and involved in local issues than they are today. The trustees' function has now changed to more of a longer tenure and removed from the political day-to-day activities of the campus, and more as overseers responsible to the state board, which probably is an improvement. I would say memorable students. We've had our share, and I think we have more probably outstanding students spread over more professional areas today than could ever be imagined years ago. I think we've got lawyers and doctors and people of that sort that got their start here. where in the early days we had some outstanding educators who, of course, came through the narrower program that was committed to education at the time. I'd say there would be a contrasting description of the faculty. The early faculty was pretty well locked into a set program, as the students were, and didn't have near the voice that they do today. Now, academic matters and faculty interaction is a prerogative that the faculty can exercise to a greater extent. The role of the administration, in the early days, the administration was pretty much, I remember as a junior faculty member, we sent a slip for each class that we met daily to the dean of the academic dean in Old Main, and on there we put any absentee students. That was a requirement. I mean, if you didn't turn in your slips for the day, as far as they were concerned, you weren't there. And so there was a track. There was a close keeping of attendance as far as the students were concerned, as well as the faculty. There was no missing of classes. It was unheard of by either students or faculty. Through the evolution of this whole thing, there was sort of a rebellion against that, and I remember after the first couple of years here, some of the faculty members claimed that this was more like a high school than anything, and we need to do away with that. And sure enough, we did away with it. So there was some needed changes made. Of course, in the early days, public support was total. Probably 90% of the budget was taxpayers' money, and the students paid their $400 a year. Now, I think the public support's maybe 50%. And so the financial structure has changed quite a bit. The decision-making is, of course, much more diverse today. Back in the days of the education dominated institution, why there weren't as many decisions to be made, and if they were, if they needed to be made, they applied to teacher education pretty much and were made by a relatively few number of people. And then it was concurred by the faculty. Of course, the objectives have changed totally from the narrow purpose to the multi-purpose institution that Slippery Rock is today. So from that standpoint, I would say I've just been thankful that I was a part of it, and I've been more thankful that I've been able to survive it and enjoy these retirement years, and I still enjoy very much coming to campus and attending musicals and plays and athletic events and activities whenever we're in town. So I consider myself a supporter of the institution and one that has many fond memories. Conclusion. Let's see, how are we on time?
We're in good shape.
3:05.
Excellent.
Well, I think with that, I'm just about talked out here. I've rambled around and I don't know.
You mentioned Coach Thompson was, I have a couple questions about him. Was that a faculty position? You said he coached football and basketball, and did he teach besides?
Oh, yeah.
Everyone did.
Oh, yeah, everyone did. There were no such thing as a separate...
No free lunch.
Coach, yeah. No, you were... The coaches were... They worked very hard. And Coach, he had... of course, he had the pressure sports. And he'd be running around, maybe with the basketball team, get home maybe 12, 1 in the morning. He might have an 8 o'clock the next morning, 9 o'clock. In fact, in all likelihood, he probably would. I mean, none of us hardly started after 9. We were all over the East-West gym over there. There were a lot of 8 o'clock classes, and by 9 o'clock, sometimes if he was out on a basketball trip, why, and they'd maybe try not to start him before 9, you know, but he'd have to be over there. And he'd say sometimes, oh, you don't have to be crazy to do this, but it sure helps. And in baseball or football, maybe someone throw a pass, you know, and hit the receiver and receiver drop it. You'd say, hit him in a bad place, right in the hands. And then when it pulled the player out, and you'd say, son, he says that ball hit you in a bad place, right in the hands. So I'd let him, yeah, Coach had a peculiar way of speaking. Food, he'd call food. Say, now, boys, you've got to get your food. And we all, you know, joked about that. He had these speech mannerisms that was distinctive. He was a big guy. I mean, he had hands like a ham, you know. He was a big guy. Like he was back from the Jim Thorpe days of the Carlisle Indians, you know, where you had to be. And he was big in his prime. Now, he was, when got to the time when I was playing for him, why, he was getting elderly. I mean, he was in the 60s probably. But I could see when he was in his prime, you know, I mean, he had hands on him, and he had, and they say he, they used to always kid him. They'd say, Coach, is it true that won the game? He'd laugh. He'd say, oh, boys, don't believe those stories. He says, most of them aren't true anyway. But, yeah, they used to kid him about that, sneaking into the uniform at halftime and playing the second half. Well, back in those days, they didn't check on eligibility as close, but I don't think they used to always kid him about that. But he was quite a player in his own right, and he was big and strong, and coached a lot of years here, and is, as a result, revered by a lot of people. And well, the single biggest scholarship fund that the university has today is was given in his memory. I mean, his players, and not only his players, but the students, the kids he had in class, and many of the women and so on. Just remember old Coach, you know, he just was a big old friendly bear, and everybody thought a lot of. And, but he spent a lot of time, well, all the coaches did, spend a lot of time over here. The time he'd finish up, it'd be 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night before they'd get home for dinner every night through the week. And his widow is still living over in Orchard Manor and is called on by his players here, I think, last fall, group of them. Yeah, they gather up $5,000 in memory of Coach and contributed it to the NKT fund, which I forget how much we have in that fund now, but it's a sizable. Bob Despirito was probably here a year or two when Coach passed away. And we used to take him out on recruiting. We started when Bob Despirito came, we got into recruiting more. We could see we had to do that. So we'd get in a car and go to various functions around to schools or meet with high school seniors, and Coach would go along and he would say to Bob, well, let's talk football. So he was still right up to the time of the, he was still interested, very much interested right up to the time the passed away. But he, quite a guy. He had no pretenses, no facades. You know, what you see is what you get. He, and that's what everyone liked about him. He'd teach health classes and number of classes. Kids used to try to like to get them off the subject, you know, get them to talking about, rather than talking about health, why to get him into sports. So, what are we going to do this week, Coach? Well, now you boys forget about that. We're going to have to learn our lessons here, learn about our food and how important it is. So, he was quite a guy.
Did you hire Bob Despirito?
Yeah. I think it was around that time we were having basically a football problem, and we seen the need to upgrade the program. So we had a lot of applications, maybe 70, 80 applications, and we sifted through them, and Bob was over at Bucknell, and so we interviewed him, and as well as a number of other people, and we thought that he could do the job for us. So got him from Bucknell, and then we said to him, well, we were expanding, so we had faculty positions that we could use. We needed to fill a couple more. We told him that he could bring one assistant with him. And Rod Oberlin was his choice, who was also over at Bucknell. And so we got those two at the same time. And, you know, I told him it was going to be rough going, that we're going to have to work at it a little while. Well, the first game, they played Waynesburg. And Waynesburg beat us, I think, 61-7. And after the game, he said, it's going to be rough going. But the main reason, looking back on it, that they beat us 61-7, they had this wide receiver who, after graduation, went and played with the New York Giants for 6 or 8 years. And he was so fast and tricky, we didn't have anybody who could cover him. It got so, I think the first part of the game, Bob had one guy trying to cover him. Then it was two. I said, why don't you try three? We just didn't have anybody fast enough afoot, you know, to stay with him. He was catching passes all over the place, and our kids got discouraged, and we just didn't have the horses. But then the next year we got a little better. I think they won a couple of games the first year. Next year we won a few more, and next year a few more, and then before you know it, you know, we had those three or four state championships, and we had the bowl playoffs, and we were running around all over the country, you know, playing people. So, but we had to work at it a little. We got so that we had recruiting groups in down there every weekend, and we'd all go in and give them pep talks about our various programs and how you ought to think about coming to Slippery Rock. I remember going down, and I was department chairman at the time, or dean, and Bob would say, well, Saturday morning, can you come in and talk to this group at 10 or 11? He'd give me a time, and he had everyone scheduled, and he'd have some faculty members come in from various programs, if he knew the kids were interested in various faculty positions. So we might have 50 high school students in there in their senior year ready to come to college, and we would literally sell them on the various programs and the value of coming to Slippery Rock. And it took time, and it would knock a hole in your Saturday sometimes, but that's what you had to do, you know. So over a period of years, we got so that we were getting 24, 25, 50 pretty able-bodied students, and some, by golly, had football ability. And when you get that, why, he was getting some depth, and he got so he gathered together a pretty good squad there. He had good morale. Bob was a good organizer. He could rally the campus to support the program. See, at times, we didn't always have that. We had, time or two, it's pretty easy for the coach to alienate the campus toward the program. But the trick is to get someone who can win friends and influence people and get everyone working to support this program, and show them that by having a good, let's say, football team, hey, we're going to spin off a certain number of able-bodied students in your area, and in your area, and your area. So it was a recruiting. We weren't just recruiting football players. We were recruiting students in various academic areas. And so we made an effort to recruit the science student, too, and all students. And if they happened to be health and physical education students, well, we would take them also, you know. But that to have a successful program, from, I'd say, Bob DiSpirito's days on up to the current, that's what you have to do. You have to have the whole college behind every program, really, and supporting it, and giving and taking, and you can realize your maximum potential that way. Prior to that, we just had problems. I mean, it didn't reflect well on the whole college, and that's why we got into this concerted effort. And by golly, it worked. Well, now today, we have a solid program. There's a few of these opponents we're playing. We don't have the manpower, people power, but it's a pretty solid program. We'll do fairly well.
Has IUP gone clear out of our league?
Yeah, they're so strong. And Edinburgh is awful strong. They gather up a lot of money there.
Alumni.
Yeah. I would say those two are IUP particularly, particularly in football, no basketball, no problem. But football, they've just come on with a lot of resources and money, and makes a difference.
Was Carter a supporter of athletics?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say he supported athletics. He supported, let's say, athletics a little more than physical education. But I think he wanted a good projection. You know, I think he wanted student athletes. I don't think he supported it to the extent that Al Wattrell did, for instance. Al Wattrell, I think, was presidential-wise, was the strongest supporter by far, you know. More happened during his administration than I'd say any of them. And he was a former player himself, and I think he enjoyed the... He went down there and milled around with the coaches and
oh, yeah, Bob told about him,
yeah.
Reading his mail.
Yeah.
And he'd do the clippings from the Eastern newspapers. And he'd underscore the good-looking prospects.
Yeah.
Some wonderful stories.
Yeah. He'd give them these newspaper accounts, you know, of budding and so on. And it was great. The only thing is... there was no way of doing it, though. We get a channel in, just smoothed it all. We didn't have to go as far as he wanted to go. And he and I disagreed.
That's not the press box thing you're talking about. It's scholarships.
Yeah, well, the whole,
the other problems.
He told me he wanted a strong program. I said, well, fine. Well, you know, but we do, too. We want to have a good, strong academic oriented program, and I'd say, well, we need maybe 100 student workers, which we had jobs for down there. We could employ all of them. He'd say, well, take 200. I went, no, I don't want 200. Just want 100. The thing is, he didn't, and that caused all kinds of trouble because I felt that was sort of a disproportionate number. Not only that, I had to employ and keep track of all these students, which was a heck of a job. I mean, I had to vouch and certify that they were all gainfully employed and they put in their time. I could do that with 100, but it was tough with 200, see? So he went on the assumption that, well, if this was good, why twice as much would be twice as, and that isn't always the case, you know. And then I tried to caution him, you know. I said, you know, your academic image and stuff is going to be damaged. I mean, you're going to raise resentfulness here as the thing up on the hill turned out to do. You know, a lot of people just resented that thing being there. Well, that didn't have to take place. I mean, if it had just gone easy, softer on it. But he was hard to...
Did he ever miss any away games?
Not very many.
Had to be a big-time emergency for him to miss.
He wanted to be there. He wanted me to be there, and he wanted the athletic director to be there. Well, we had a couple of Bob Raymond, and we were there. I mean, most of the time we were there. Anyway, but occasionally we wouldn't be able to get there. But, if we'd have just tempered it a little, hey, I think we could be floating along today. We didn't really have to go overboard, you know. We were doing very well. And by the way, Bob DiSpirito would agree with me. But that was an interesting experience. Previously, I mean, we didn't put near the resources into the program. Now we're putting more than we ever had of private funds and so on. You know, we have more scholarship monies, and the alumni and various people have given these funds. Now have grown to the place where we have more than we ever have had, but then Indiana has had twice as much as they've ever had, you know. And so if you want to compete with them, why, you have to do what you have to do to compete with them. If you don't, it's sort of an injustice to the kids to send them out there, you know, against sending boys out there against these grown men, you know.
Does the size of their enrollment impact on all this? They've got 14,000, 15,000 or so.
Yeah, it's well over 10,000, but I think what impacts more than anything is that they've got a bigger source of private funds. I understand they've got an oil well, and, you know, they've got some things. They're pumping oil and bringing in money off it all the time, you know. And that just gives them more to do with.
Doesn't the NCAA place limitations and restrictions on the use of that money, or
oh, yeah.
How many scholarships they can support?
Yeah. The NCAA Division II restricts the number of scholarship people, full scholarship people you can have, but we don't have enough money to come up to that level.
Aha.
Thing. And a lot of the other, California doesn't either, or Lock Haven, I'm sure, Ship, maybe. And if you don't have enough money, and you're not, let's say you're allowed 35 full rides in football, if you don't have enough money to support that, then that's your problem, you know. So now you're going to function with 15 full rides, or how many ever you can afford. Well, I don't know how many we can afford now. I don't know how many we have. But I would guess maybe 20. And I think the NCAA, you're really allowed 50. I think Indiana has 50 and without any problem. And they're all full rides. Doesn't cost them a cent. Well, our students, they might only have half rides or a third. You know. So now if you're a student coming out of high school with some football ability and Indiana approaches you and say, well, I'll come to Indiana, it won't cost you anything. Or when we say come to Slippery Rock, it's going to cost you $1,000 a year, or we can help you to the extent of $1,000 a year. Your parents maybe are going to say, hey, son, you're going to go to Indiana. Say, well, now it doesn't cost me anything. That's about what it comes down to. Now that just applies to football and basketball, and probably to baseball now anymore. But when you get into the, and girls basketball and girls softball, but when you get into the other ones, well, even the tennis players and the golfers get, there's two or three of them that get some help. And soccer players. But those sports aren't recruited as heavily, say. So you can get by, if I'm a coach, I can get by better on a smaller budget in soccer than I ever could in football, say, because the best football players are heavily recruited, but the best soccer players are, they're sort of recruited, but I can probably find some for free that if I coach them hard, I can bring them up to a level that they'd be competitive, say. On football, I could find some that are free. I could never coach them up to a level that that'd be competitive. It's about as simple as that. So that's the way it is today.
Did the coaches have academic rank when you came?
Well,
had that been installed a long time ago? Or?
Right, we were faculty members first, and coaches incidentally.
And now that's just changed recently.
Yeah.
They're all
during my time as an administrator down there, we pretty much held it at that. But now they can be working someplace else and coach here. It was during my last years or two that it was changed, that you didn't have to. What happened, we people got tired coaching, went out of it, and we didn't have any new faculty positions. So what could you do? Right? But now, I think they pick up quite often, and all these schools do it. They pick up their local high school coaches, maybe, or some local. They can get the fellow downtown that's an enthusiastic rooter, you know, and sign him on as a coach. And of course, same with high school. I mean, it isn't as bad in college as it is in high school. I don't believe, because in high school, you know, you're working with younger people who are more susceptible to injury and so on. But they're not educators. Of course, we might say the same thing about the science. Let's say the scientist who was a lab person for a big chemical company, he's not an educator either. But we bring him in and have him teach chemistry, don't we? Particularly if he's a Nobel Prize winner or something, you know. And we don't look at his educational credentials. And so, see, that's the argument. But we always thought it was more sound if we had educators coaching. But now, let's see, I think on the current football staff, you've got maybe three that are full-time faculty members, and the rest of them are the ones from Grove City, former coach over there, and I think he still teaches over there. One's a high school over in Montauk, and just get them wherever they can get them.
Does that matter, make a difference in relationship with the rest of the faculty, or does it not matter with the rest of the PE faculty?
Yeah, I think it makes a difference. Like in some of the other sports, I'm not sure. Now the volleyball coach, she just comes and coaches volleyball and goes back home. You know, other than that, you don't know anybody on campus. They don't know her. So there isn't any, I mean, she can't feel part of the academic program hardly, except that they are representing an educational institution. So whatever effect that, probably at the college level, these kids are sophisticated enough that.
That's all written into the collective bargaining agreement, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's all part of the. It's the way it's been negotiated. And
were you able to stay outside pretty much of the Carter firing and then the Wattrails firing and all those kinds of hoorahs that we went through?
I was able to stay outside of the Wattrail firing. Because boom, I mean, it happened, you know,
yeah,
I was probably the last to know about it. But the Carter firing, I think I was the dean then. And, you know, people brought petitions to me, saying, here you go, sign them. And I said, you know, no soap, I'm not signing any petitions. For what? Now I'm sure that made some unhappy and others happy, you know. But,
well, you were a part of the administrative team.
Yeah, I was part of the administrative team.
You either support it or you don't support it.
Yeah, and Carter supported me in a number of instances, and which I always appreciated. I mean, I can understand how Carter got into trouble and what the problems were, but from a health and physical education administrator standpoint, Carter gave me probably as good a support under trying, difficult circumstances as I had as an administrator. The worst thing in the world, you know, is trying to administer and have a very soft support base. Worst thing in the world. With Carter, I had a support base that I didn't always agree with, but I knew what it was, which is comforting. You know, that's my preference. You know, maybe some other people wouldn't have chose this way. Okay? I didn't always agree with it, and the same with Wattrell. I didn't always agree with him, but I knew what it was. Like you say, in a big instance, you know, I was always trying to get him to tone down his support of athletics and telling him the dangers, because I'd seen it before. I'd seen what happened, you know. I decided to him. He said, oh, it never happened. And if it had just listened and soft-toned it a little bit, he'd probably be here today, is my assumption. Because a lot of people, you know, he was pleasant. He got around campus and, you know, everyone, I don't think anybody, and, you know, he could have, but he just pushed so hard that some people resented it. But, yeah, so they brought me that, and Carter, after he was gone, he came back a month or two, and we were talking. He says, Bill, he said, I was disappointed you didn't support me any stronger than you did. And I says, what do you mean? I said, they brought me petitions. You didn't see my name on any of them, did you? You didn't say anything else.
Was he terribly upset at when you saw him after he had left and come back?
No, he was sort of reserved.
Sort of, yeah. Handled it fairly
well? Yeah, yes. Very. Oh, yeah. I don't think he looked on it as the end of the world or anything.
He had enough ego that he was going to land on his feet.
Oh, yeah, he knew he had a niche waiting for him someplace. And, I think he went up to Ferris State, Michigan. Over Denison, he was highly regarded. You know, Denison has a high academic... high academic program, and he was highly regarded as an academician over there. But then he dabbled in sports as he used to go out and help officiate track meets and do some things that small colleges, I think, like to see faculty do, private colleges. And he loved them to mill around with the coaches, but he kept it in better perspective with the academics. Then he knew that the heart of the university was academics. There were days when I wasn't quite sure, you know, whether Al Wattrell fully he'd get out there and get the rah-rah on, and that it was gung-ho. So, and we didn't need that. I mean, I told him we're going to dominate this thing with what we got. We don't need all this stuff. But I couldn't talk him into it. But like you say, I mean, I'd rather know what my backing is than to have a very wishy-washy, weak backing, not knowing quite where you stand. See, I mean, you can't function that way. If you know what it is, then at least you can function. You may not be able to function the way you want to, but you know the way you have to go. But when it's wishy-washy, why, I mean, it's by gosh and by golly, and the whole program, it looks that way, too. That's my, I had a couple of favorite expressions here that Bob Abersole still quotes, and that is, I remember the president, more recent one that went to Maryland, and we had these management meetings occasionally, say, around. So at this one management meeting, Bob Abersole's there, and we're all on. He said, now everyone write up a couple of slogans or something that we're going to have to incorporate in our management style. So we were in a crunch at the time, and I thought, well, gee whiz, an appropriate one would be frugality out of necessity. So that's what I wrote. Frugality out of necessity is our watchword. Well, I had a number of others down there. Sent them in. He looked them all over. Next day, we're meeting again. He says, I've got one here now. This is really something. Frugality out of necessity. He didn't like it. He didn't like it very well. Everyone sort of laughed, you know, and I thought that was very appropriate. And I stuck up, you know, I said to him, I thought that was very appropriate. I think maybe that's something. And he made a joke out of it at the time, and a couple of times, you know, joked with me about it. But Bob Abersole still uses that today, you know, frugality out of necessity. You know? And then the other one, we were up Old Main once, and I think it was during Wattrell's administration. We got down to, we were having a debate over what programs and how we were going to advise and so on and so forth. And I got sort of impatient when it was late in the afternoon, long meeting. And I said, well, I don't care how you decide this, but I said, I'm sick and tired of trying to throw a blowout patch on a leaky program. It was an advisement thing. So every time I come over, why, Bob Abersole says, we still use that expression, throw a blowout patch on a leaky program. But if our students are advised properly, you end up with them down the line, you know, and now you have to try to patch it up, and that's really what we were doing. We would, at the last minute, in their last semester or so, we would go to all these lengths to advise them or change, make exceptions, or so that they'd meet the qualifications to graduate. And, you know, I had a hard time buying that. I said, if you have graduation requirements, why, by golly, we have added graduation requirements, and we had a sequentially planned so that the student can meet those graduation requirements. Not ill-advise them where somehow they go astray over in these other areas and come up short, and now you at the last minute, you try to make maneuvers to make them eligible to graduate, you know. So that was the main point. We had a little fun out of it, and I guess that's why we were successful and maintained our sanity. You know, we used to get some jokes out of it. So,
were there some other people that you remember with affection, or maybe lack of affection, over the years?
Well, really.
Influential.
Yeah, every president. I really, you know, Dr. Weissenflew probably annoyed me as much as any of them. But even the day he left campus, you know, we shook hands and were on good terms, and I wished him well. And I said we didn't always agree, which we didn't. for various reasons. He was subject to pressures and influences from other people, which I was sort of idealistic at the time. I was young, fairly young. And I thought that he ought to just, you know, recognize principles like I did, and hey, just follow them. There was nothing to it, see? Well, I found it wasn't that simple. And of course, that's the way I approached him. And he was being badgered and influenced by other people. And the principles really weren't as important as the pressures he was getting from the other people. And but as I look back on it now, if I'd have been a little more mature and smarter, why, you know, every president along the line, they're badgered by a lot of people, you know, and some give a little more and a little less. And I would say one of the most resolute in their principles and ideals was Carter. And we all know what happened to him, you know. but if you want to say, well, gee, a guy who really sticks by his guns, hey, that was Carter. I mean, he had some ideas, and he stuck by them. And that's probably what got him into trouble, as much if he'd have been a little more flexible. And, well, yeah.
So Weisenflug changed them from time to time.
Oh, yeah, he'd vacillate quite a bit.
Management matters, or?
Well, yeah, administrative matters that affected the whole college. It would cause, affected athletics and physical education was the part, because I was sort of acting chairman at the time. But that's how I got into administration. He appointed me acting chairman. Back in those days, I mean, a chairman was an appointed position. It was a administrative position. And so to be a chairperson, someone either in the academic dean's office or the president's office had to look on you favorably and appoint you. That's the only way you could get there. And Weisenflug appointed me acting chairman at the time. When we left, he says, Bill, he says, I'd make you permanent, but he said, I think the next president ought to have that prerogative, say. Well, which is fine, you know. So I can, but he was so soft and fluctuating in his support that I had a hard time figuring out where I was, you know.
In terms of how much budget you had to work with, and
yeah, and the size. Things had changed in a hurry. Someone would go in and beat his ear, and hey, it was that way for a day or two. Someone else would beat his ear, and you'd be that way then. So you'd wonder, well, who's going to go in there next? Say, I'm going to get down to that. And that makes it tough to function. So,
how did the Michigan Stadium thing evolve when we played those two games? We played twice, University of Michigan?
Yeah.
In that 104,000 seat?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that took place, let's see, I was the dean down here. Bob Raymond was the athletic director, and he knew the athletic director up at the University of Michigan. And they were talking, and what it boiled down to is that the motivation was they wanted to fill their stadium or utilize their stadium to quite an extent, while their team, University of Michigan, was playing out on the coast. So they were out on the coast playing UCLA or those California schools, and hey, things were pretty quiet there around University of Michigan and the 102-seat stadium, say. He says, well, how are we going to fill this thing? Well, we could get two smaller schools with the name, and Slippery Rock was one of them, and a Michigan school, Wayne State. The other ones had a comparable program, Division II, were about the same. Wayne State's a lot bigger institution. But football-wise, we're fairly comparable. So, okay, we get those two teams in there, and they bring their fans, But that isn't going to fill a 102 seat stadium. That's only going to, he figured, bring maybe, at the most, maybe 10,000 fans between the two schools, because Wayne's an inner city. They have no following. I mean, they might have brought 50 fans. We had the rest of them. So we'll make this band day, and all the high school bands are on, college, any outstanding bands. So he gathered up all these bands, got them in there. Well, then each band brings a lot of band parents, you know, and they got them in there. And so when it was all said and done, we had all these bands which stood and played and made a tremendous musical sound. It's 65,000 people. It's the biggest crowd we've ever played before. And we played Shippensburg one year and Wayne State the other. Yep, 65,000 people, and we got a pretty good financial, covered our expenses and gave us, I don't know, a few thousand dollars to put in the bank. And we were playing somebody comparable, you know, and there we were in this 102-seat stadium with the AstroTurf and everything, and it was a nice sunny afternoon, wasn't that far. Worked out all right.
Great PR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good public relations, and I don't think we played very well either time. I think we lost both games up there, maybe not. We lost to...
Shippensburg was a lopsided score.
Yeah, they
the other one was fairly close.
Yeah. That was close.
They won in the last little while.
Yeah, last little while was about 65,000 people, you know, for whatever reason. This guy was a promoter. He was, and I'm sure he made a few bucks, you know, out of it. He was trying to make his athletic program, I think, more.
Of course, Michigan has this great reputation as a music school.
Yeah.
Oh, like Indiana.
Yeah, they have a big music following. And I enjoyed the band. It was something to see that many bands all crammed in there. Yeah.
How did you get to Slippery Rock in 53? Who made the connection and all that?
Well, I was... C.M. Long was the... Well, I guess you'd call him the local superintendent of schools, but he was also the director of the laboratory school. Employed half by the local school district and half by the college. And I think he asked some of the staff members at the time, Bob Smiley being one of them, and I think I was winning at the time, and I was getting pretty good write-ups in the Pittsburgh paper for about seven straight years, you know, football and basketball. We were at the top, or pretty near the top. And so Bob Smiley was one of them, and in fact, I remember, I think C.M. Long asked him, well, hey, we've got this vacancy on physical education laboratory staff, who should we ask, you know? So I was in football camp up in Laurel Hill State Park, up in the mountains there. And someone called me long distance, said, hey, we've got this position, would you be interested? And I was right in the middle of trying to shape up this team, and it was going to be a good one. And I said, well, can I call you? Yeah, he said, but we can't wait too long, he said. You're going to have to call me. I said, I'll be home that Saturday, so about 3 or 4 days. So when I got home, I called him, and I talked it over with my wife and so on. She was a Slippery Rock graduate and so on, so she wasn't any doubt in her mind. She said, we ought to get up there, so we decided. But I hated to pull out, it was right in the middle, and so I had to leave this school district in the lurch, you know. And, but Not until they found somebody. They did find someone to fill in.
What school was that?
Well, they called East Allegheny now, but it was East McKeesport then. It was East McKeesport, and so they put them all together, North Versailles, East McKeesport, Wall, and Wilmerding. They put together and made East Allegheny out of it. And when I left, I had been there 7 years, and I had a woman principal that I communicated real well with, and she became superintendent shortly after I left, and a couple other of the administrators they had there. We got along real well, and they tried to keep me from leaving. They said, "Now, if you choose to stay here," he said, "we're going to be combining, and we'll have a principalship and so forth, and we'll make you the principal, and we're going to take care of you." Well, I had been involved in the public school discipline enough and so on. I knew what principal said. I said, "Nah, I don't think that's my..." So they wished me well, and I was gone. But I had, seven beautiful years down there and probably learned as much as I was able to partake, you know, give to them, I hope. I felt I learned a lot. They worked my fanny off. That was back in the days of the smaller high school, you know. I mean, really, so I had all the health and physical education, football, basketball, and baseball, and all the tough discipline and study halls, and a POD. I was certified in social studies, so I'd senior POD, which I like to prepare for, and we studied the problems of democracy. You know, every year we studied statehood for Alaska and Hawaii, and that was one of the problems, and which came about, you know, and which we went through. There were a number of problems, and we discussed them and researched them and so on, which there was a lot of work involved in it. And then I had every study hall where they're allowed to be kids that would act up, say, and you know, I could discipline them. But that kept pressure on me all the time. So for 7 years I had that, and that sort of got tiresome. So when we got a chance to come up here, when I went over to lab school, it was a breeze, you know, I thought it was a breeze. Because I'd drag home like 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, and have dinner and fall asleep in the chair. Get up, you know, I'd have to be in school 9 o'clock the next morning, had a class, ready to go, and right after school coach again. And then in my spare time, I got my master's degree. I'd commute into Pitt.
That's when you were really young.
I think we all did at the time, but I remember coaching basketball, and so I'd have to quit practice, knock off practice a little early, 5:30. I'd run out, jump in the car, eat a sandwich while I was driving, because I had a 6:30 class in Pitt that night. I'd have two classes, 6:30, 8:30, 8:30, 10:30, and 10:30, jump in the car again, drive home, I'd get home around midnight or so, and then I'd have to get up the next morning and be ready for class at the high school, you know. That's how I got my master's. I said to myself, you know, if I have to do this on a doctoral level, never happened.
Can you tell us a little bit about women's sports at Slippery Rock?
Women's sports at Slippery Rock, I think, pretty much mirrored the trend of the time. We probably had more for women in athletics than the average university. But I mean, we were still plagued by some of the restrictions of the times. They were debating whether it was good for women to play full court basketball. They played a game which was he could only, they couldn't go over a certain line on the court, so they were really only playing about like half-court basketball. And it wasn't good for them to maybe swim or sprint or at certain times, and so they were hashing that out. The big thing here for years, when I was a student for women, and was women's field hockey, where they went after that with a lot of enthusiasm, and gymnastics, dance, and tennis. I would say that was the main extent of the women's sports. Well, then, as ideas became more liberal as far as activity for women, well, then we started to add more sports, and we went to full court basketball, and softball has come on. In the early days, they didn't play softball for women. Now, they did have archery back in the early days, and some schools actually had archery competition, which women excelled. Golf, we had an outstanding woman golfer here, Janet Anderson, could have played with a men's team, and there was no women's golf. She's on the tour now.
Oh yeah, she's won the LPGA. And
she's been scoring. I've been watching her maybe $5,000-$7,000 every week at these events on the women's tour. So she's a heck of a golfer. So there was a case where if we'd have had a women's program, maybe she'd have stayed and played. She played with the men. But she only went, I think, a couple of years and then dropped out. And that might not have been the reason. But women's field hockey was big. And then it's gradually grown. But back in those days, there were some high schools without any physical education for women at all. My wife went to a high school there. The only activity she had was cheerleading, I think. They had no gym classes or anything. I guess it wasn't legal for them to get too exercised. But anyway, it's grown. It's a good thing. Oh, yeah. And then back in the early days, you know, the facilities just were not shared equitably. I mean, the girls couldn't get on the boys' varsity basketball court, and they got either at an undesirable time or so. Now there's an equal sharing of facilities, and there's an equal number of sports, and there's the same variety of sports. When they cut them, they cut two men, two women's. So everything is more equitable. But back in the early days, you know, they debated and studied, and physiologists and anthropologists, and they all claimed that there were could even be damaging to women to run around too much. But they've worked through all that.
And they were all out in the fields. Yeah. Putting up hay. And
yeah. Some medical people even at the time, they made these studies, you know, women shouldn't be sprinting or conditioning.
They must have missed the pioneer period.
Yeah. They forgot all about those covered wagons and stuff where they came across, and maybe they'd have a baby and jump into the covered wagon and be part of the, grab a musket and hold off an Indian. You know, so now as we look back on it, it didn't make sense at all, but it was highly debated. When I was a student here in 1940, 41, 42, I mean, the women's program was very control. Gymnastics, field hockey, some half-court basketball, and some volleyball. I think probably that was about it. And I'm not sure. I don't think they had any competitive swimming. Today, you know, you got these girls, young girls, and you see these young girls at in New York here recently playing in tennis there. My goodness. 17-year-olds.
World-class tennis players.
Yeah. Every time she hit the ball, she grunted, you know. They hit the ball 109 mile an hour. They had the gun on them a couple of times. So that's been revolutionized. That's come out of the dark ages.
How's the retirement going?
Good.
We have three retirees here at this table.
Good.
Leah's been, you retired
like
a year, and I've been gone 2 years. And you retired in
82. Yeah, 82.
Mm-hmm. You did 30 years here, 7 years in the high school.
With my military time, I was just a month shy of 40 years service in the retirement system. But I bought 3 years military time, you know. But I'd have been teaching during those times if, you know, I hadn't been in the military. So I was just about a month shy of 4. I figured that was long enough. And I've enjoyed myself since. Gives you a little time to do the things you always wanted to do, and go at a slower pace, and if you have your health, why not? That's the important thing.
Well, did you have something? You have a benediction?
No. No, I think, what time? It's 4:05.
Yes.
We talked away that second hour. So you asked me a few questions, and that's what you get.
But thank you very
that
much.
That was great. Thank
yeah.
you.
Enjoyed it. I'll be waiting to hear from you, and we'll cross out all that blasphemous stuff about it.